Accession number 9338, reel 5.
Doug Turner, take 5. When did you actually leave Elmsett, Doug?
I left after 2 years. Edmund, there had been a division within the community. Bert was becoming more and more rigid in his approach and was beginning, unfortunately, to take over the role of a benevolent dictator. It brought great tension into our lives. I think it was a very sad moment when it came to a head and Edmund left. He left very sadly, and a number of the group went with him and they formed a new community, but the worst elements of the, or the more negative elements of the community, went with Edmund, and within a matter of weeks it had dissolved. Those of us who remained continued to do battle with Bert.
And his mother.
And his mother.
Could you give me an example of how she stirred things up?
Yes. Oh, there are so many examples. Obviously, as a woman, an elderly woman there, she was not sympathetic to us. Her whole feelings were quite understandably for Bert, and she needed outside relationships. She used to go to the village, and she made friends with one or two people in the village, and we got stories coming back of the rather terrible things she used to say about us as individuals and how we, the rest of the community, were making poor Bert do all the work, and we were all lazy and disorientated and this sort of thing. And at times I think Bert began to believe it also. New members would come along and Bert would say, "Ah, now these are the right people. These are the people we've been looking for." And, of course, they would come in and they would get a wonderful welcome from Bert, and in a matter of weeks or months, the same story occurred. And Bert was far more utopian than we were, although in spite of his age, one would have expected him to be more practical. In fact, I suppose one of our own failures was not in recognising this. We had looked to him as being the most practical person, and the down-to-earth person, the Boanerges, one might say, perhaps. Alas, I mean, it was not to be.
Was it very disappointing that it all fizzled out like this? Was it very disappointing for you?
Yes, of course it was. I felt torn between two ways, and I found myself in, unfortunately, in the horrible position of sitting on the fence. Others were coming down on one side or the other, and I just was not clear. I could see both sides, and I couldn't make a decision. My feelings were with Edmund, but I felt that once he went, that the new community would not last, as proved to be the case. I decided to stick it out, but it wasn't easy. More and more, it came that we had almost a completely new group of people with rather different ideas to what we had had in the beginning, and Bert and I were the only members of the initial group left. All the rest had gone their various ways, some into other communities, others into other forms of usually creative work. The new group, which was coming into being, were more disorientated as a group, and perhaps because of that, tended to take Bert's side when it came to issues. I don't know. It's awfully difficult to make judgments these years later, and perhaps one tended to make too harsh judgments at the time. anyway, at the end of 2 years, one or two members had already gone to the Bruderhof and had already joined. Edmund had ultimately finished there. Rather reluctantly, I felt myself into a kind of a logical impasse. I didn't particularly want to go to the Bruderhof because there were issues there which I felt I couldn't wholly agree with, although I did have every respect for their way of life, their commitment, their sense of community. I just couldn't go along with some of their theological beliefs. Anyway, some did. I went there. I stayed there for a few months, but again, I came to this point. I accepted a sort of a kind of a logical alternative, but it wasn't an emotional one. And I left and went out without a penny in my pocket. And just the clothes I stood up in and a cycle to ride. And I cycled off into the blue.
I'm not quite sure about the Bruderhof. Did you say that they were interned in the war? Had they sort of come together again at this time?
This was a period when they had not yet been given their marching orders. So I went there when, in fact, they were beginning to move slowly. They had, after long discussions, they had found a home in Paraguay. And they were then beginning to be engaged in sending people out as the situation developed. So I arrived there when the migration was underway. But the previous year, I had spent a few weeks away from Elmset, cycling around with another community to visit other communities in the country. And during that time, I had visited White Way, which lay in the middle of the Cotswolds, a few miles from Stroud, and which had been founded in 1898 by a group of Tolstoyans who had been imbued with his teachings and had decided to found an anarchist community. And they'd bought this plot of land in the Cotswolds. And although the colony still existed in name, by this time, of course, it had become a group of individuals living in their own separate establishments. It has its own history written by Nellie Shaw, one of the original founders, under the name White Way, and one may find its own history there. Anyway, I had arrived there and had stayed there for a few days with Nellie Shaw, who had very kindly given me accommodation, and on this occasion I made a beeline for White Way, hoping to find work in that vicinity, but being sure that at least I would be given some sympathy. I arrived there, and Nellie very kindly put me up, although she was then quite an old lady. And within a matter of days or so, I had found myself a job on a farm and began work.
Could you tell me about your work, something about White Ways while you were there? What sort of community was it then? You know, it still retain some of these Tolstoyan virtues?
Yeah. I think it had started off in the very beginning in a very lackadaisical way, very, very idealistic. But I think with very individualistically orientated, rather perhaps than individualistically and collectively, perhaps I should say, rather than communally, although their intentions were sincere, but there was perhaps a tendency to place more emphasis upon the individual than the community. Although they owned the land in common, it wasn't long before it became separate plots of land. and much more of a settlement rather than a genuine community as we visualise community, in that perhaps it contained the seeds of its own destruction. And also, I think they, being anarchists as well, they had no formal structure. They even at one time burnt the deeds of their property, which led to problems later on in the history of the colony. By the time I had arrived, there were a few of the old pioneers still living there. Happy people, contented people, fair enough. But most of the people were newcomers. Although the land was collectively owned, it had been agreed that the homesteads which the individuals had built there could be sold. And this is what was happening, and therefore many people from outside were able to move in and buy the homesteads and thereby occupy the land as well. The land is still communally owned, but to all intents and purposes, it is just very much the same as a small village settlement.
And would the people have been pacifists there? Were they all?
Some were. Some were, yes, there was quite a strong pacifist element still there. Nelly herself was never a wholehearted pacifist, as she herself would admit. And for example, she supported the war, but she was very sympathetic to people like myself, although there were certainly some pacifists to whom she took quite strong exception. I seem to be, again, one of the fortunate ones, that those who came under her tongue duly suffered from it. She could be quite venomous at times. But anyway, she and I managed to hit it off, and she had quite a liking to me, towards me.
How did you get on with farm work? Was it easy to get
there it was. Yes, it wasn't too bad. I searched around a little bit, and then I there was a farm bailiff who had just had a new house built for him, and he wanted somebody to lay down the garden, so I took on that job, worked very hard, and was duly observed, apparently, by the owner of the farm, Mr. Michael Sadler, who is the son, or was the son, of Sir Michael Sadler. I never knew Sir Michael Sadler, although he had quite a reputation, I think, as a believe an Oxford Don. Michael Sadler himself was an author, having written the novel Fanny by Gaslight. He was regarded in the vicinity as a fairly solid liberal man, of solid liberal outlook, although I was a little disconcerted when he, after coming along to his bailiff and saying, well, when that man's finished your garden, I think I'd like him to work for me. Ideally found myself offered a job by Michael Sadler, and I was only too pleased to accept a job, but then he wanted to pay me less than the agriculture worker's wage, 2 shillings a week less, and I said, well, I'm sorry, but that is the minimum wage, and if you want me to accept a lower wage, well, then I don't wish to work for you. And he rather disagreeably agreed.
Did that happen often, do you think, with conches?
It may well have done. I wouldn't be surprised. We found it almost at times when we went out to work for a local farmer, maybe to help him with his threshing. Almost inevitably, he would try to cut us down. Farmers don't change their mentality, I think, over the years, you know. They're pretty tough. They're out for every penny they get, and I haven't found them all that different. But maybe I'm being cynical.
But do you think they singled you out because you were?
I don't think so. I think they took advantage of our naivety. I think that was a tendency. And, of course, I mean, probably in many cases, I mean, the average pacifist coming from a fairly non-working non-manual background, didn't find it too easy to adapt to a farm worker's mode of working. All in all, I think they expressed themselves quite well. However, after a few short period of working with Sadler, I developed a very severe conjunctivitis of the eyes, quite severe, and this meant me going down fairly constantly to the hospital. And after a period of this, I found myself without a job. But, again, very fortunately, the bailiff of the neighbouring farm had constantly been looking over the fence at me, and no sooner was he aware that I was free than he offered me a job. I said, well, look, you know, if you want a job, you come and work with me. And I gladly did so. This was a Major Milne, who was a gentleman farmer, and he took his fair share of joining the army when war broke out, and left his wife to look after the farm. And I had a very, very happy time working on that farm. In fact, during the ongoing years, I in my movements, I left once or twice, and always went there knowing I'd get a job, and always did. And even today, I still maintain excellent friendly relationships with Mr. Milne. I had quite a happy time working on the land in the Cotswolds on that farm.
How did he treat you as a pacifist? Did he understand your position?
Oh, he was a very tolerant man. He was a liberal, and when he was home on leave, he'd come and work with us in the fields, and we'd have some good arguments. But he was one of the best of gentleman farmers, a barrister by profession. And although he didn't agree with me, he was a truly liberal man, and we deeply respected one another, and that respect continued on for 40 years. He's now, of course, very much retired, but we still have contact, and if I go down there, well, we're on personal names, and there's no master relationship in any way whatsoever. And when I was in India recently, I mean, he sent out quite a nice donation towards the work, and we've maintained a good relationship.
Did you have any CO friends when you were doing this farm?
Yes, I'm glad you raised that, because there were quite a number of COs who settled in the area, because there was a forestry scheme going, and of course they employed pacifists, and there were quite a strong little group of objectors living at White Way. So we maintained a strong group there. We were very active in the Peace Bridge Union, and it was at that time too, I think, that Oxfam started, and we gave due support to that. We saw this as a practical exposition again of what was happening at other levels in society. Most of my comrades, I think, worked on the forestry section. One of them was Brian Sorensen, who was the son of Reg Sorensen, the Labour MP. He being one of the few pacifist MPs, and it was through Brian, indeed, that at a later stage I ultimately joined the Friends Unit. He having done so at an earlier stage.
Do you think it was important to have support at that time, you know, to have other COs around you?
Yes, it certainly, those COs who worked on their own on farms must have felt very isolated. Indeed, I know they did. And for a group to be together as we were, although we had our separate jobs, gave us a feeling of oneness and unity and strength. No doubt about that.
Did you ever meet any pacifists, any COs, who really had no other support at all? You know, what were there people like this who were sort of individual?
I'm sure there must have been. Of course, there were the pacifists who weren't necessarily a part of the peace movement as we knew it. Small sects and things like this who might have felt very much alone. But one person comes back to mind very strongly, and that was a man named Chris. I was on a journey to see George Dixon, and he had been in contact with a man who had lived in the Midlands, and they'd been exchanging one or two letters, and George had asked me to call in and see this man in the course of my journey, and I gladly did so. And I arrived in this rather scruffy West Midlands industrial area, climbing up the cobbled street to his home. I'd already written to him previously, and he'd already invited me to visit him and stay the night. And it was a rather drab November day. And arriving there, he opened the door of this small terrace-built house and gave me a very warm welcome, and I became aware then that as he shook my hand, some of his fingers were missing. And I didn't take too much notice of it at the time. But later on, as we sat down to talk, we soon became involved in a one-to-one discussion, and he told me his background. This was that he had previously been a regular soldier, having spent some time in India, and had then come back out of the army, married, and now a man, I suppose, in his early 30s, had a little boy, and had then rather casually began reading the New Testament, and had found himself more and more enthralled with what he was reading, particularly on reading the Sermon on the Mount. And as he read this, he began to question what it all meant, because it seemed so much at variance with the Old Testament. And then he began to compare his reading with what was going on around him and the practice of Christianity as he had understood it. All he had, I suppose, had ever known was what the padre had preached during his stay in the army. And this had led him to consider the question of war. Of course, he was expecting, or would have been expecting, to be had been called up as soon as his age group arrived. And he realised, as he had read the Sermon on the Mount, that he could no longer participate in any acts of violence whatsoever, that the words had real meaning to him. But at the same time, he was quite unaware that there was such a thing as a peace movement. Pacifism he'd never even heard of, that anybody could ever refuse to fight, he just had not considered. He'd heard of nothing. I mean, his upbringing had been very limited. So many of his years had been spent in the army, where he just obeyed orders without question. And now here he was, questioning everything. And he just didn't know what to do. He knew he couldn't go back into the army again, but where could he, what could he do, what would he do? He hadn't even heard of any such thing as tribunals, or that there was a legal means of explaining his position. He knew nothing. And he felt terribly, terribly isolated here. And he tried talking to his wife about his feelings and his thoughts, and she just couldn't understand what he was on about at all. Occasionally he might have put out feelers, apparently, to friends or acquaintances, but he lived a pretty lonely life, and even when he did, he found no sympathy or understanding or no explanation. One time he thought of going to a clergyman, but his own experiences with the padres had showed no... He felt he wouldn't get anywhere there at all. And he was deeply worried. At the time, he had a job in a paper works, and it was when he was working there that he began to think of other means. If he got called up, he would have to go. And if he went, how could he not be put in the position of a fighting man? He just didn't know what to do. He thought maybe if he aimed the rifle aimlessly in the air, he might get away with it, but that didn't seem very realistic. And the more he thought, the more he saw the shining blade of the guillotine come down to cut through the paper. And he thought, and he thought, and he thought about it. And finally, this seemed to be the answer. That was the logical answer. And one morning, he went to work. And at the appropriate moment, he put his right hand out as the guillotine came down. It needn't have happened, of course. The firm couldn't understand why he'd made such a terrible blunder, because he was well thought of at work, apparently. But he went along to the first aid room and had the injury attended to. The firm, deeply concerned about the incident, and offered to put him into another part of the factory. He refused, and he also refused all compensation. Went back home. He felt at times that his wife might suspect of what had happened, but he never told her. And having to find work, he set up a little business as a window cleaner. And that was what he was doing when I turned up on the scene. I asked him whether he really had no idea at all that there was no other people of like mind. He said, none whatsoever. And you were the only person who really believed that you were the only man in the whole world who had come to this decision, this conclusion. He said, yes. I had no conception that anyone anywhere could believe what I believed.